You hear me okay? So as Jen was saying, one of the questions we've been asking ourselves this week is, what can we do to make space for the critical conversations of open education? As she said earlier, we've kind of used Twitter and these lunchtime conversations almost like an escape valve, right, for some of these things that are building up inside of us. So first, perhaps, is just to make space in these conversations for voices like Edward's to say, can we really question the notion that openness is in itself a virtue? And what kinds of closings come with the notions of openness? And how do we think about diversity in terms of openness and open-endedness in openness? So these questions really push back on statements that we've heard like the opposite of open is broken. We suspect that openness is more nuanced and complex than that. But we see learning management systems that tout openness as a virtue, and we recognize that that's probably a different definition of openness than some of us have. And so we want to kind of push back on the assumption that open is good and closed is broken, because it doesn't really allow us to unveil those unhelpful dichotomies. So the notion of not yetness is one that we've been using a lot, Jen and I, to kind of think about what are those dichotomies that really drive conversations in higher education broadly, in digital education a little more specifically, and now in open education even more specifically. And how can not yetness be a way in which we approach openness as teachers and as change agents at our institution? So just to give you a little background on where this notion of not yetness comes from, it actually doesn't come from conversations that Jen and I were having about open education. It was from conversations we were having about digital education. And we were building on something that George Valencianos, or George V, was writing in his book on emerging technologies, where he talked about he defined emerging technologies as not yet fully understood and not yet fully researched. And when Jen and I kind of started writing a chapter for the second edition of this book, we really latched on to that notion of not yetness, not as something to be kind of pushed away, but actually something to be embraced and to think of not yetness as a fruitful place in which conversations about critical issues in digital education, or in this case, critical issues in open education, can really occur. So not yetness for us is a fabulous lens for that. So when we first started talking about it in terms of digital education, it became a response to this kind of broader set of narratives that you see in digital education quite often, which is kind of this utopian view of educational technologies. Educational technology will save education, or these really narrow conceptions about what education is and what educational technology can do, along the lines of technology can help to control what happens in your classroom. So Jen and I were really, really troubled by those calls to formalize strict interactions with technology, the calls for heavy-handedly applying notions of best practices, and limiting the notions of quality and success to these very, very narrow metrics of what could be measured through educational technology. What we really wanted to see is, could we use not yetness as a way to bring out the things that are emergent, speculative, deeply personal, and different ways of thinking about how people learn. So when we think about not yetness in open education, we think it can draw us back to context, to diversity, to variability, to uncertainty, and therefore be able to work against the tendency to assume a one-size-fits-all approach. It helps us to reduce the politics of complexity that Noel Goff was talking about before that Jen mentioned, and to think about the conditions of radical and enduring uncertainty, unpredictability, changeability, and contestability that we think are really important in education. When you think about those really amazing times in your teaching and learning experiences, those are typically the parts of your education that are deeply personal and contestable and transformative, not the ones that had a very particular specific ending where you reach those narrow learning objectives. So we believe, and we ask you to discuss with us today, I know this is a full house, but we're going to try to have a little discussion today at some point about whether or not yetness can help us to make space for discussions about openness as a virtue, to make space for voices like Maha Bali, who writes a lot about this. She wrote something recently in Hybrid Pedagogy, and Adam Heidebrink-Bruno, who talk about inclusive education rather than open education. So here's something that Adam wrote recently that I thought was particularly interesting. He said, openness is not a neutral concept. It has been designed in such a way to protect its own, which has historically been white men of privilege, race and Western tradition, particularly in the global north. That, by definition, is not very inclusive. I found it quite disheartening that nobody was talking about this at the conference. He's writing about last year's conference, Open Ed conference. Well, none I could hear anyway, which is sort of the point. We do not need a more open education. We need a more inclusive education. So a lot of times when I'm talking about not yetness, there's a metaphor that comes to mind. I'm reminded of Gloria Anzaldúa's piece, one of the most poignant pieces I've ever read, called Borderlands La Frontera. This has nothing to do with educational technology. It has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, except that I think her view of her critical feminist lens on, in this case, the U.S.-Mexico border is a really interesting one that we could apply and think about in terms of not yetness. So when Gloria writes about the border and the borderlands around it, she writes about a physical border. You know, in this case, this is actually a picture of the border between U.S. and Mexico going into the sea. What an interesting view. But she also talks about the emotional and psychological border of her mestiza heritage. For Anzaldúa, the border and the borderlands around it were a place of incredible underdeterminedness. And that created both fear and uncertainty in her, but also she recognized the cultural richness of the borderlands around the border. And she talks about the notion of crossing boundaries between one or the other, physical, emotional, psychological boundaries that she crosses as a person of mestiza heritage. I love the statement she makes. She says, borders are set up to define the spaces that are safe and unsafe, to distinguish us from them, to determine what's open and closed. But the borderland is a vague, underdetermined place created by the residue of an unnatural boundary. Sometimes I feel like the conversations we've been having here have been about this unnatural boundary of openness. So what's around that? What are in our borderlands? How can this kind of metaphor really help us to understand what we're talking about here? So rather than stop at questions of whether something is open or not, or whether openness is inherently a virtue, or how broadly to define openness, a productive approach may be for us to look at the spaces and practices and ways in which people cross boundaries between things that are open and things that are not, or things that look at like a variety of different forms of openness and approaches to openness. I love what Sheila McNeil wrote when she shares about her experiences of crossing the boundary between openness and closeness in her own work. She says, in trying to support others to be open, I may for a time appear to be closed and may even feel a bit broken and bruised. I'm not working with broken people or systems, just ones that need time and support to be comfortable with being open in ways that work for them. So the conversation that we hope to have today is whether not yetness can really help to allow us to have fruitful conversations about what's around the borders that we create in openness. What are our borderlands? And what kinds of conversations can we have in our borderlands that lead to discussions of diversity and context, that lead to discussions about what can emerge from our open educational movements, what can be open-ended and embracing open-endedness, what does authority and authorship mean, and can we completely blow that up? Do we need to? These are all important questions. And what is risk-taking about? Can we actually use risk-taking not as a way just to say risk-taking will get us to slightly beyond some outcome that we expect, but risk-taking will take us to a completely different set of outcomes that we would never have been able to predict. So we have heard many examples this week about open educational practices, open educational movements that do some of this boundary crossing and ask some of these questions. And what we want to do for the remaining time we have is to have you surface those, both in your minds. So think about some of the things you're working on in open education or that you've heard about this week, and ask some of the questions that we think are related to the not yetness of those projects. We have put together some questions that we think are related. We're going to share those with you, but we struggle with these questions. These questions are very not yet, if you will. And so what we want to do is actually put them up for you and ask you to think through them in terms of the projects and conversations you've had this week. And then we want you to tell us, are these good questions for thinking about the not yetness of our projects? are these questions that help us to surface the tensions at work here and surface them in ways that allow us to ask even better questions? What are better questions that we could ask instead? So the questions that we've been thinking about, we've been trying to answer them in the context of our own experiences with openness, but they're difficult. What space is there in our open projects and our projects that we think are open for distinctiveness and diversity and open-endedness? How much uncertainty can our approach to openness accommodate? And what closures, and this is the hardest one, I think, of all of them. This is the one we still struggle to answer. What closures come along with our openness? And what's in our borderlands? So we'd like to ask for, we have about 10 minutes remaining or so. If you would think just for a minute about the project you've been working on, the things you've heard about this week, and think about these questions in those contexts. What comes to mind? What questions are better for this kind of thing? And we're asking if you just yell, go for it.
One thing that comes to mind for me is the way that our borders are set by institutions, but the transgression is set by individuals. So for a lot of us, navigating that borderland in the same way that it's talked about in that book is that it's the institutions that set that space into which we wander. And I often think that we're not punk enough in our approach. That we are ultimately, I think, deep down about control, prestige, jobs, families, money, very Western ideas. But maybe we need to be more punk in that space and not to use a loaded term, but disrupt the institutional processes or concentrate on that rather than our own motivations or experience or feelings as a way forward in terms of that not yetness. So thinking that institutions will change, but not yet. And we need to be in there forcing that change more abruptly by blowing things up. Not to use a terrible metaphor, but I just did.
What comes to mind when you say that also is that there's a question there about corporate responsibility, right? Because if the institutions are setting the terms of the discussion, but the individual staff and faculty member are the ones taking the risks, then that creates a kind of situation where I think we are seeing something that's like a kind of open closure sort of situation. So it's not even so much that, and not everyone's in a position to take those kinds of risks, and those risks might not actually be worth taking in some instances. And so I'm really, really interested in what you said. Thank you.
Somebody tweet that, by the way. We should be more punk in our approach. The other thing I would say, too, is we didn't really talk a lot about the notion of prestige, and we've kind of, you know, touched on the topic of power. But I think those are two incredibly important concepts that we don't talk about enough in our institutional context. You know, one of the things that I found since Jen and I have begun working on not yetness, I did a talk when I was applying or when I was interviewing for the job at Middlebury. I did a talk on not yetness as part of my interview. And what I found to be really helpful about it, too, is that not only did it allow me to surface some questions and questions at the very outset of my time at Middlebury, but ever since then, when people talk to me about what they're interested in doing, they often talk about it in terms of not yetness. They'll say, you know, I have this thing, I'm thinking about it, it's, you know, the not yetness looks like this. And I'm like, that's fascinating. We need to have more conversations that allow people to be completely in these weird borderland spaces and to surface the tensions that they feel.
So I think the punk rock metaphor maybe is useful. I think of myself, I'm a bureaucrat. I mean, I'm a bureaucrat in a state organization. And I have certain ideas of what I think, what change can happen, what can't happen, right? But also think of myself almost as a mole, you know, someone who's planted there. And so when I see the tweet stream, you know, I get a little, my hackles raised sometimes when, you know, there's sometimes a dismissiveness that the thing you're trying to accomplish isn't pure enough or doesn't contain these things, rather than how can the people who have the kind of freedom of expression and to experiment, because it's very useful to people who are out there asking these questions and kind of experimenting and interrogating these things help funnel in that, and how can we bring it into these institutions where there's not a receptivity to this? I mean, it's very tactical, black and white, and usually you're making sausage, and the product that you get at the end maybe is not what you really kind of feel like you're super proud of, right? But it's really helpful, it's been helpful to me to have this kind of network, keep this stuff in front of me as a contextual. It's not, it doesn't always make it into my work, but it's kind of there as finding opportunities. Because really, kind of my experience is when you're in this kind of bureaucracy, you've got to look for those opportunities, you've got to look for sympathies, you've got to, and sometimes when you just get an opportunity to introduce something, it spreads a little bit. But it's not helpful to me to feel like I'm somehow working for the man and, you know, I need to kind of give it the program, because I think it is very nuanced, and, I think there's degrees to this. So that's just one of the requests.
The one other thing that reminds me of, something that Jen and I have had a couple of conversations about, related to that, I think, is that one of the questions we ask ourselves when we think about the framework of NIGETNIS, the framework of NIGETNIS even feels kind of like an oxymoron in some ways, is we wonder a little bit, is NIGETNIS as an approach kind of a privilege, right? Does it, you know, because we're at institutions, or I'm at an institution where I can take some risks, right? And that's, I'm kind of safe to do that, and I'm safe to ask these questions. So that is certainly something that we, again, that we view NIGETNIS as a really fruitful way to start those discussions and to say, okay, now where does this really fall apart? And where does it allow us to ask better questions about the work that we do? So I really appreciate those questions.
I think you're the official person.
I'm not sure if it's a question or not, but I have. I'm not sure what I have. It's possibly a provocation. And I want to kind of say something like, there's no such thing as openness. Right? It's not a thing in the world. It's not a positive quality of thing. There's no essence of openness. When we talk about openness, we're really just talking about the removal of some restriction to activity, right? Which is imposed by something like copyright, for example. So if the primary state of human being is to do anything you like, right? Then we have this level of restrictions and barriers, laws, rules, regulations, norms and so on. And I see openness as the kind of process by which you attempt to eliminate these barriers, the restrictions to activity. One analogy you could use is the idea of a kind of positive and negative freedom, as Isaiah Berlin's philosophy. So the idea is that when you're saying to someone, be more open, you're not giving them some new potential, new freedom. You're just taking away some negative quality. And if you think about openness in this way, then a lot of these kind of critical questions that you've got, to my mind, evaporate a little bit, because they're based on the sort of linguistic confusion about what is openness. Is it a thing, or is it just a way of talking about things? So what do you think about that?
I would like to recommend my colleague Jeremy Knox's paper on limitations of access alone, in which he addresses Berlin's notions of freedom in a way that I found quite interesting and definitely not do justice to. But I think I think what you're saying is really important to me, not because I agree with you, but because it's a really clear articulation of the kind of end goal of what you might be trying to do in your kind of practices around openness. And I think we need a lot more of those kinds of conversations and probably arguments, which is difficult because, as we were saying the other day, you know, a lot of the momentum that comes from a conference like this is about people deciding they can work on something together, and then we get into fights about what freedom means and what sort of essential state of the human, is. We might find it harder to get some other stuff done, and nevertheless, I think we still have to do that. We have to find spaces for it. So that was my response, which was not really a response, but.
This just got me thinking about the conference in general. I'm another state guy, so we've had a big plan and we're trying to measure success, and yet I'm hearing a lot of tensions between basically four terms that we use as practice in open: adoption, adaptation, creation, and open pedagogy. As if they're somehow separate from each other in a lot of ways. So, you know, this initiative funds the creation of research. resources. Whereas this initiative, they're just using what's already out there. But then within a lot of the projects that we're seeing with adoption, there's a lot of creation of new ancillary materials. There's a lot of personalization of materials for a specific course. I mean, those all tend to blend together, whether you're supporting one more than the other at first. And then open pedagogy should always be a part of these implementation projects. If it's not, then you're not looking at what you're using and how you teach it. So I just feel like there's been that this overarching tension between these types of these signifiers that are arbitrary but useful, causing some tension.
Yeah, that's right. It's like they're useful until they're not useful. And figuring out that moment when you have to then say, oh, actually, that doesn't mean anything. Let's start again, is, I think, really challenging.
I think your insight about the funding model is really important, because I think a lot of what we talk about in these particular environments where we are kind of talking about in terms of collaboration rather than asking the critical questions is because of the way things have been funded. And so when you look at, and this was, so I was having a conversation over a very large piece yesterday with Mike Caulfield, and gluten-free pieces, good. And we were talking about how the funding that Hewlett has provided around OERs and how they've defined OERs as this thing has really set the tone for a lot of the conversations we're having. And that's, again, something we need to be talking about in these circles, because it absolutely does impact the way we talk about this work.
Brian, do we have time for one more, or do we need to stop?
I don't want to stop it. Probably, let's do one more question.
I just wanted to say, one of the things that converted me early to the open movement was the way that openness sharing is a parallel to education. And it feels to me like this not yetness is what education is all about as well, right? Like, we want to keep growing. And so if there's fear and uncertainty, well, that produces growth, you know? And this, to me, it feels like everybody's more excited and more interested in growing and learning than they are in kind of feeling off what the outcome should be and saying, okay, we did that check. And so it feels to me like, I don't know, the potential of open pedagogy and open education is limitless precisely because it's kind of messy and it's a place where we're all still learning and growing. And I mean, part of the energy that I feel in the conference here is just because we feel like, wow, we haven't figured this out yet, you know, and that's what everyone likes best. And students like feeling like they're part of something that's not quite in place yet either. I think it's more stimulating.
You're here. I think that was a great way to end. Thank you so much.